Mike Braun makes his move for governor. The Senate approves a same-sex marriage measure, plus abortion poll numbers, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending December 2nd, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana U.S. Senator Mike Braun filed paperwork with the state to run for governor in 2024. Braun is in the middle of his first term in the U.S. Senate. Prior to that, the Jasper Republican was a state legislator for 3 years and served a decade on a local school board. The governor's race is an open one in 2024. Current Governor Eric Holcomb is term limited. Political scientist Andrew Down says Braun leaving a safe Senate seat to enter what's likely to be a competitive gubernatorial primary does seem like an odd move, but he says given Braun's profile, it's also a logical step.
He came out of the business world where he got to be the boss and the CEO. And when you're a senator, you're one of 100 and you are not the boss. So this is a chance for him to move back to the top of the hierarchy.
In a statement, Braun Chief of Staff Josh Kelly said Braun will make an official announcement about his candidacy very soon. Is Braun the favorite to grab the GOP nomination for governor? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Chris Mitchum. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Chris Mitchum, is Braun the frontrunner?
I think it's kind of a tough question to ask right now just because we all expect, you know, one, two, three or more people to throw their hats in the ring come 2024. But I think as of right now, when you take the two individuals in there, I think you say he has to, just strictly off of name ID alone. Obviously, Eric Doden out of Fort Wayne, businessman up there. I've talked to a lot of the local elected officials in that area, and they say he has a pretty good lock on just the northeast corner of the state. Obviously, he's done a lot of really good work up there. And when you look at Senator Braun, I think in 2018, he ran a really competitive Senate race where he defeated a really popular, in terms of Indiana, a popular senator in Joe Donnelly, and all of the funds that were expended to just get his name out there with campaigning and name ID and things. I think that can pay a lot of dividends come 2024. But one thing I'm really interested to look at, though, is just the assets on both of these individuals so far. I think the Doden campaign just came out and said that Eric Doden has over $2 million on hand. And then obviously we saw Mike Braun contribute millions of dollars to his own campaign in 2018. So this could really create a barrier for other people that says, hey, if you want to play in the sandbox, you got to bring the assets to do so.
Yeah, Chris just talked about it's hard to gauge whether he's the front runner because we don't know everybody who's going to get in. There's a lot of speculation Suzanne Crouch, the lieutenant governor, will get in. But to Chris's point, too, now Mike Braun has said recently he doesn't want to self-fund in the primary this time around. But we know he can. And is that is that going to be a barrior for some folks who might have otherwise gotten into this race?
I think it could be a barrier. But again, as Chris said, it depends on how many get in. I mean, if you have Suzanne Crouch and you have three guys, I'd put my money on Suzanne Crouch. Even in the Republican Party, if they're ever going to get beyond the glass ceiling on women, that would be the time because she's a popular lieutenant governor and she has at least as much name recognition as he does. I don't know. I mean, he's giving up the Senate seat, obviously, and, you know, he's he's not done anything in Washington, so I guess it doesn't really matter from that point of view. He's an election denier. He voted against that very popular program in Lafayette for Purdue and CHIPS, which would mean big paying jobs for Indiana. So I don't know how well he'll sell. And, you know, now, you know, he votes against things that people think are popular. For example, is he going to say there should be an absolute ban on abortions in Indiana? Is he going to propose a ban again on marriage equality? All those questions he's going to have to answer coming back and running for governor. He could have ducked them as he did a number of these before, but he's not going to be able to do that now.
He ran. He didn't just beat a popular Democratic U.S. Senator, Joe Donnelly. He also got through a primary against two sitting congressmen, Todd Rokita and Luke Messer. Now, Messer had kind of taken the more centrist, slightly more moderate Republican, and no one has ever accused Todd Rokita of being that. And so Mike Braun found this lane in the middle to say, hey, I'm not an insider. I'm a Washington outsider. He was kind of running a little bit of the Donald Trump playbook in that sense. You can't do that again if you just spent 6 years in Washington, D.C., can you?
No, I don't think so. I mean, and he will have to come up with some highlights to show a record for what he did for 6 years. And in addition to that, he's going to have some ideas for the future. One of my pet peeves in recent years covering races like this is no one has any like proposals or ideas for what they want to do if they become governor. I'm really hoping we have some actual concrete action once we get into 2023 that candidates start talking about.
Again, we've heard other people potentially thinking of throwing their hats in the ring. I mentioned Suzanne Crouch. Congressman Trey Hollingsworth has been one who's been circling. Todd Rokita, possibly,
has
exported in the past.
Mitch Daniels hasn't said an absolute no.
Mitch Daniels hasn't technically said an absolute no, but I'll come back to the question I started with, which is, even with all of those other names, is Mike Braun, given, if nothing else, the pocketbook, is Mike Braun the front runner?
I would think that somebody who is an incumbent U.S. senator would have to be given the edge. In terms of fundraising, not just in Indiana, but that opened the door to exposure to deep-pocketed funders across the country. And I presume he could pull those strings and get dollars from those groups, those individuals. That's a significant factor, especially when you're dealing with somebody like Eric Doden, who has a sizable chunk of change going into this. I think Doden was hoping he could scare away people, but it's hard to scare away somebody who also has deep pockets and access to more.
Yeah, I mean, he's got more than Eric Doden's got more than $2 million right. in cash on hand, right. But a sizable chunk of that right now is himself, his family.
Family, right, and friends of family.
Which, but still, given this far
money,
in advance,
but money spends, you know, right. and we understand the strategy of trying to have that big dollars. But I guess the point is, the more people get into this, the less predictable it becomes. If you had one or two candidates, maybe three, you can go to Vegas and place your bets with some sense that you're going to be able to come out ahead. Yeah. You get 5, 6, 7 candidates, and all of a sudden things start to splinter.
Well, that reminds me of the U.S. Senate race, which is going to be interesting now. We'll talk about that in a future show. You wanted to say something else.
Yeah, I know. One thing I wanted to add was, you know, we know the size of this pocketbooks of Braun and Doden. Hollingsworth also does not have a small one. And then one could argue that Suzanne Crouch is the best fundraiser out of all three of them. So I think no matter, you know, who...
You can distinguish yourself in a pack of guys
right.
in suits.
So no matter who goes up there, I think this is going to be
if you're a Republican funder with a record of giving, you're going to be... You might want to just put your phone on, your phone off the hook or change your forwarding address.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is U.S. Senator Mike Braun the front runner to be the next Republican nominee for governor? A, yes, or B, no. A couple weeks ago, we asked you, coincidentally, should Mike Braun run for governor or senator in 2024? 22% of you said governor, 78% said senator. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the U.S. Senate this week passed the Respect for Marriage Act, a bill that aims to provide some protections for same-sex marriage. Indiana's senators split. Todd Young voted in favor. Mike Braun opposed it. Same-sex marriage is currently legal in many states only because of a 2015 U.S. Supreme Court ruling. If that precedent were overturned, same-sex marriage would once again become illegal in those states, including Indiana. The Respect for Marriage Act ensures that the federal government would still recognize same-sex marriage, even if the Supreme Court takes away the right, and it would force states where same-sex marriage would be illegal to recognize marriages performed elsewhere. In a statement, Todd Young said the bill treats both same-sex couples and people who oppose same-sex marriage because of their religion with dignity and respect. Mike Braun's office did not respond to a request for comment.
Ann
Delaney, should this bill be much consolation for Hoosiers whose marriage rights still hang on the whim of a panel of judges?
I don't think so. I think some of it helps if because of the full faith and credit part of it that's in there. That's good. That's positive. But when you have a Supreme Court as political and as Trump-like as that Supreme Court is, there is no such thing as precedent. And they could just as easily decide as soon as some state passes a restriction on same-sex marriage, which will happen in Republican-controlled states, could it even happen right here in Indiana. As soon as that passes, they will overturn it, and just like they did Roe v. Wade, and we'll be back to fighting the fights and the cultural wars because the Republicans can't stop themselves. They can't stop themselves.
In terms of the votes we saw on this, is this kind of vote exactly why Todd Young just won re-election so easily?
I think you could argue that just because, I mean, a huge basis of his election campaign that he just ran was, look at me working with the other side, passing the CHIPS Act. I brought, you know, the Secretary of State to, you know, Indiana and took pictures with him and all, you know, all the whole nine yards. But I think the whole just conversation around this bill is strictly ideological. I mean, I think the side that's upset with the passage of it, nothing that somebody that voted for it can say can really alleviate that. It's just so ideological that you're voting against, you know, what they believe in. Granted, I think Todd Young did a good job in his editorial that he brought out saying textually, kind of trying to bring it back to the text of the bill, this isn't really going to impact anything, kind of to Ann's point. You know, we're still explicitly protecting a lot of the religious liberties that, you know, you've made progress on in the past few years. But, you know, politics is a crazy game, and if he had an election next month, you know, his vote could have been different. But with that in 6 years and with kind of the pace of changing you're seeing in the cultural landscape, you know, this could be a memory.
Yeah, I want to focus on Todd Young for one more second, John, which is, so before the election, I got to sit down for an interview with him, like many people did, and I asked him about same-sex marriage. Would you vote for a bill that protects same-sex marriage at the federal level? And he said, first, this is a distraction. Nobody's actually trying to overturn marriage rights, which is currently true. And then he said, well, I'd have to read the text of the bill, which everybody says. And then he said, I don't know if the federal government should be in the marriage game at all. That at this point, other than, like, it's mostly a religious ceremony, and maybe the government should just get out of it entirely. But then he went and voted for this bill. He had a very clear reasoning why. If this vote comes before the election, is that vote different for Todd Young?
You know, maybe not. I think that he correctly has read the zeitgeist here, and the evolution of that public sentiment. We've talked many times on this show over the years about just how this issue, the notion of marriage equality and equal treatment for people, depending regardless of their sexual preferences and lifestyle choices, that has gone from one end of the spectrum nationally and in Indiana. It's over, not overnight, but certainly in the scheme
faster
of things.
Faster than a lot of things.
Oh, yeah. Incredibly fast. And I think any student of politics and anybody who purports to have a finger on the pulse of the electorate, as you would hope an incumbent U.S. senator would, sees that there's no gain, really, in being on the other side of that issue.
Well, there's another incumbent U.S. senator whose pulse didn't work that way.
Maybe that's why he's running for U.S. senator. We just talked about
the Mike Braun potentially being a very competitive primary for governor in 2024. So is this a vote in eye of that primary?
Probably, though I honestly think that's the way Mike Braun would have voted regardless of whether he was running for governor. I just think that ideologically that's where he falls on this issue, and he's made that clear over the years. So I think that's the way he would have voted even if he was up for Senate this year or next year, you know, or governor in 2 years. So I wasn't surprised by his vote at all.
Well, it may help him in the primary. It may not help him in the general election.
Yeah. Especially if this, I mean, as we pointed out, as I pointed out in the piece, Indiana still technically bans same-sex marriage in the state law. It's unenforceable because of the Supreme Court.
Right.
But if that should ever change, it might be a conversation that before a Supreme Court case, Indiana at some point may need to have at the state legislative level. And if he's running for governor, he may have to answer a question like that.
And Nikki even mentioned in the last segment, like, you know, what concrete examples can Mike Braun give when running for governor? He can say, I opposed a lot of what, you know, these moderate Republicans were supporting. You know, I am the staunch Republican you want to vote for in the primary.
Nikki was saying, instead of proposals,
in a primary. Exactly.
What I'm against, what we should disband.
But in a primary, it could benefit.
All right. More than 80% of Hoosiers believe any abortion ban should have at least some exceptions, and more than half say abortion should be legal in most cases. Those are results from the Indiana Public Broadcasting Ball State Hoosier Survey. About 78% of those polled say abortion should be legal in cases of rape or incest, and 62% say it should be legal if the fetus is likely to be born with severe disabilities or health problems. Indiana Republican lawmakers passed a ban this year that allows abortions only in some cases of rape or incest, and the law permits abortion if the fetus can't survive outside the womb. Some conservatives want the state to restrict abortion further, but Ball State political scientist Chad Kinsella says, given these poll numbers, that's a tough sell.
And could be politically, you know, a political landmine. If it's big if, capital IF, if they go that route.
Kinsella also notes that nearly half of those polled say they wouldn't vote for a candidate whose abortion views were different from theirs. Nikki Kelly, do numbers like these make it less likely that we will see major abortion legislation in the 2023 session?
No, because the lawmakers had those numbers last summer. They paid $100,000 for their own poll, and they already knew what those were, and they still passed a near total abortion ban. So I don't think it impacts the debate at all in 2023.
Now, last week, or 2 weeks ago, I don't remember. Time has no meaning. We got a chance to talk to legislative leaders, Republican legislative leaders, Organization Day and things like that. And, of course, we asked, hey, are we going to see more abortion, anti-abortion legislation in the upcoming session? Todd Young, boy, I'm doing it again. Todd Houston, the Speaker of the House, said, no, we're going to stand pat. Senator Rod Bray said pretty much exactly the same thing while adding, hey, you know, there's a Supreme Court case that they're going to hear in January, and we don't know when they're going to decide. We're going to at least wait for that to find out what they say is or is not okay under Indiana's Constitution. So, yes, they had poll numbers and didn't really care. But now that at least the leadership wants to stand pat, is this the sort of thing they can go to their members and say, look, people want us to just lay off at least for a little while longer?
No, because I don't think leadership, I think they have had, just as they had this information before, they probably quietly made that argument before about carving out some exceptions and doing something that doesn't seem too draconian or too strident. And there's a faction of the caucus that ignored that. And there's a faction of the caucus that will ignore any plea, however, you know, whether it's delivered with honey or, you know, with a hammer lifted over someone's head, and they say, you know, let's not address this now. There will be bill after bill after bill that will be introduced. Now,
the difference between an introduced bill and introduced a bill that gets a hearing.
That doesn't mean that they won't get attention, though, and cause headaches, because I'm sure there will be news coverage. And the backers of those bills will see to it that their supporters rally at the state house and make sure that, you know, why isn't this bill being heard? Well, this committee chair, you know, with the chair of this committee to which this was signed is not giving it a hearing. I can just write the script now. And so there's a group that doesn't care.
Yeah. So then to that point, Rod Bray, Todd Houston saying, we're going to stand pat for at least the 2023 session. Can they get away with that?
I think so, just because of the leadership and this way they have at the Indiana State House. And I think you guys are absolutely right when you say, you know, push comes to shove, there's a bill in front of you that eliminates exceptions, for example. Republicans are going to pass that. They're going to vote yes on this. But can this maybe impact the vigor of that leadership of saying, I think the Supreme Court, the Indiana Supreme Court case is absolutely valid for Senator Bray to say. But I think this may have an impact on the vigor of the leadership saying we have to do something versus if, you know, the uproar might not be as loud as the numbers may say to, you know, force them to do something.
We have 19, I think, Nikki and I, we counted it recently, 19 new members of the General Assembly going into 2023. We had votes on getting rid of the exceptions for rape and incest in both chambers. It was exactly 31% in both the House and the Senate who voted in favor of those things. The numbers haven't changed that much, so are we likely to get, certainly stuff will be filed, but are we likely to see any significant anti-abortion legislation?
I think this all depends on what happens with the Supreme Court and how quickly it happens with the Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court says there's a remedy in Indiana that allows choice up to a certain period of time, they are going to lose their minds, okay? And they are going to start drafting a constitutional amendment to ban abortion. And there, you know, the irony, I think abortion played somewhat in this election, but not as much as I thought it would, and that's because everything has been freeze-framed, and people don't understand the process, and they think it's okay. If that changes, you can bar the doors.
I think you're right. The temporary ban on the bill, that actually has been, for Republicans, probably the best
thing
politically that could have happened to them, because people have not been denied. We haven't seen those headline-grabbing stories.
It certainly didn't seem to make a difference like in Indiana at the statewide level, but, I mean, Democrats picked up a seat in the House in a year when Republicans had a very good election in Indiana.
And they picked up a seat against anti-abortion activists, too.
But they also lost a seat in the Senate.
They did lose a seat in the Senate.
Was all due to gerrymandering.
I was just going to say, that map was pretty rough.
Gerrymandering is always the answer.
That's right.
Well, it is. When we have 90, we're rated 95% of our districts are gerrymandered. All right. And we're really good at it.
That's Hoosier excellence. Indiana.
Exceptionalism.
Indiana lawmakers are expected to explore ways to help address the state's housing crisis in the upcoming session. And ahead of that debate, the Notre Dame Student Policy Network and Prosperity Indiana this week proposed policies to help renters. Indiana is one of only five states without a rent escrow or repair and deduct policy. They deal with situations where rental units have serious habitability issues that landlords aren't fixing. Jessica Preddy is a case manager with Family Promise of Greater Indianapolis, an organization dedicated to eliminating homelessness. She says she's worked with families facing situations like this.
A family who wasn't able to pay rent because they weren't able to work because of all of the mold that was in their home. They were hospitalized several times because of it and fell behind on rent.
Under repair and deduct, the family could make the repairs themselves and then deduct the cost from their rent. Under rent escrow, the family could ask a judge to allow them to put their rent payments into a third-party account. It would get withheld from the landlord until repairs are made. John Schwanis, these things have been proposed at the State House before, but with the push to address the housing crisis and a bipartisan recognition of just how bad it is being such a major issue in the upcoming session, is that the sort of thing that can get these proposals over the hump?
One would think so, but as this is going to sound like the answer I just gave in the last question, where we had, in that case, we were talking about, you know, poll numbers and the sentiment of the population of Indiana. And now we're talking about real significant threats to the livelihood and well-being of families in the state of Indiana. The reactions may be the same, because there's such, among some individuals, such an ideological aversion to seeming to confront, you know, landlords, that there's almost a presumption
landlords
that landlords
in Indiana,
keep in mind that, so Indiana, as
there
we've
are
pointed out, is
of
one of,
too.
What, five or six states that don't have this kind of escrow mechanism. That's no accident. Keep in mind that a few years ago when Indiana had legislation that would have given renters greater latitude in dealing with their, and in fact, you know,
Indianapolis had it.
Yes, I mean,
took it away.
Right, took it away. Preemption, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And did so even over the objections of their own party, their own governor. So that doesn't happen by accident. That same sentiment. You were talking earlier about how the lineup hasn't changed a great deal, 30%. Well, guess what? The lineup hasn't changed a great deal. And even though the crisis is more pronounced and we're getting more attention because people are unable to pay their bills, for some people, it's still ideologically, you know, that's not my job. That's not government's job.
No,
we're not going to do it.
It's also, it's my pocketbook. Is really what's at work here.
Yeah, we didn't see either of these proposals, if memory serves, in the report out of the Housing Task Force. I don't think that was an accident.
No, I mean, the Housing Task Force just had, all of those could fall under, theoretically, one proposal to address substandard housing.
Yes, that's true.
So they could theoretically fall under that sort of overall thing. But I agree with John. I mean, I don't think the political landscape has changed at all in the House and Senate. The crisis has worsened, and so it will be a little bit harder, I think, for them to explain, you know, why they don't want to give renters any options, you know, to fight back against these.
Well, one of the arguments that I've heard in the past is, well, we have substandard housing laws, you know, you can, but they aren't being enforced. I mean, there are lots of examples of cases where people are living in substandard conditions and landlords aren't doing anything and they don't seem to have any remedy.
Is
to Nikki's point, is it getting harder to say no?
Oh, I think so. And especially when their pocketbooks are concerned. I mean, it reminds me a lot of the nursing home debacle a few years ago. I understand when you have a citizen legislature, by definition, you're going to have conflicts. But when it conflicts with people that are living in mold-filled houses and having to be hospitalized because of it, and the landlord's not required to do anything, and they want to evict them anyway because they can't pay the rent, it is so egregious that they finally, I think, will have to look at it seriously.
And I want to ask you from this perspective, which is part of the reason they're also looking at this is increasingly becoming a workforce development issue,
right. Mm-hmm.
Which is we are going to have more trouble attracting businesses to this state and to either grow or expand. We are going to have more trouble attracting people we need to come to the state to fill the jobs that we need filled. Is that going to be enough to motivate something like this.
I mean, you even saw it in the report, right? As soon as kind of like the big manufacturers start chirping about, hey, my employee can't come to work because he doesn't have a place to live, I think that absolutely can move the needle. And I like how we've already related abortion to housing and then, you know, nursing homes to housing. But this kind of reminds me of the hemp issue a little bit, as in, you know, you have a report that comes out and it's really going to move the needle, as in they're not going to adopt a bill that says this session. That's not going to happen. But can, you know, an outcry like that lead to it being explicitly discussed in a study committee and then maybe just even being introduced, having a hearing? Like, I think those baby steps would be good if this report can cause something like that.
So in 10 years, they may do something.
I don't know if it'll take 10 years.
I mean, they
if
did,
we're talking about the hemp issues.
They certainly did propose to extend that housing task force another year, so, you know, maybe next year.
Yeah, they did. They were going to come back and study that. I mean, at the end of the day,
we're
that housing
talk some more.
That housing task force, the most likely is a bunch of regulations go away, right?
Some. I mean, I was actually really impressed with that task force.
So no, I
hope for some good legislation.
Well, even Senator Fadi-Kadura thought he was
that's,
a good.
That's right. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Chris Mitchum, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelist. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.